If you live in the West, you probably know the term downwinder. It's what we've come to call those people who were exposed to toxic radioactive fallout when the government was testing nuclear bombs in the open air in the 50s and 60s, most of this in the Nevada test site. And it's not just a nickname. Downwinder is a term of art. It's a legal designation assigned to certain people in a law that was passed in 1990. The law is the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. You'll hear people just call it RECA. And according to RECA, if you lived in certain counties in the West during certain years and you developed certain cancers, you qualified for a lump sum payment. But the RECA law was based on this assumption that the wind only carried the radioactive fallout from a nuclear explosion so far, that its impact was limited, contained. It's what Mary Dixon thought, at least at first.
I was a journalist, and I was doing a lot of freelance work for a paper called The Desert Sun. We kind of monitored the Nevada test site. We looked at leaks. We looked at protests. We looked at people trying to end nuclear testing. I was doing this work. Then I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. So I have this surgery. They take out my thyroid. They take out lymph nodes around it. They give me a radioactive cocktail, as they called it, to drink to get rid of whatever tissue was left. And I had to stay in the hospital for at least a week until the Geiger counter they held up to me registered that I wasn't emitting radiation anymore. Then I met a photojournalist named Carol Gallagher. She came to town and I was assigned to write a piece about her work. She was collecting oral histories and photographing downwinders all around the West. And I'm interviewing her, and she's talking about the cancers you can get from radiation exposure. And when she got to thyroid cancer, I just kind of said, oh, I have thyroid cancer. And she stopped. And she said, where'd you grow up? I said, Salt Lake. Did you drink milk? Yeah, from a local dairy. And sometimes we'd go visit my grandfather and drink it straight from the cows. And she just kind of looked at me and she said, you're a downwinder. And I said, no, I didn't grow up in southern Utah. And that's when she said, you people are so naive. It didn't stop at county and state borders. It went everywhere. And she showed me a map of where that fallout went. It went all the way across the country, up into Canada, and Utah's almost completely blocked out. I grew up under those clouds of fallout. I grew up in that hot zone. It was stunning, shocking. It was like being punched in the gut, thinking, my own government did this to me. In the name of protecting us, they poisoned us. And they did it over and over again. My own government bombed me. This is how I got sick. This is how all these people I know got sick, and many of them have died. Once I saw that map and I thought back to my childhood where we used to play in puddles of rainwater, we used to put vanilla and sugar into snow and eat it, pretending it was ice cream, and we drank milk every day. It was delivered to our house from a local dairy, and it made me go back and think, oh my God, all these things that were these happy memories of this idyllic childhood were really things that were making me sick, and I had no idea. And that's kind of when I started doing a lot of reading, a lot of research. My sister and I started looking at everybody in the neighborhood we grew up in, which was the Canyon Rim neighborhood near Parley's Canyon. And we ended up counting people in our childhood neighborhood who got cancers, tumors, autoimmune diseases. And our list got up to 54 people. I had so many stories coming my way, it was overwhelming. And people don't know this story, they just don't know. And it always kind of struck me that the vast majority of people who were affected by exposure to radiation and fallout will never know they were. And I think that's really tragic. So the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, RECA, was a way of trying to find some justice for downwinders. And that was passed in 1990. President George H.W. Bush called it compassionate payment, that the government had made these people sick, and it was presumed that it was caused by exposure to radiation. But it never went far enough. So RECA will expire this June without congressional action. But exposure to that radioactive fallout can manifest as cancer anytime during your lifetime. That means people are still getting sick, they're still being diagnosed, their cancers are returning, they develop health complications. It's not over, and the stuff has a long half-life. It doesn't just go away. It's still contaminating our planet. And to me, a government that harms its own people has an obligation, a moral responsibility to do right by them.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of the downwinders. As you just heard, there's reason to believe the fallout from the nuclear testing period in this country has had wide-ranging effects. The writer and historian Sarah Fox has focused on this story in the American West, and she joined us recently. Over the years, there have been a lot of nuclear tests by different countries, on islands, on ships, from towers and balloons. There have been tests underwater and underground. And the most dramatic, of course, at least for those of us who live in this region, were the ones conducted in the 50s and 60s in the open air of the Nevada desert. So all told, more than 2,000 different tests. And that's where we began our conversation with Sarah Fox. Why so many?
There's a great line from the writer Rebecca Solnit that this weapons testing was a way of making war by display, as some animal species do, rather than by directly engaging the quote-unquote enemy on the battlefield. And so each of these tests that was conducted, you know, very early on, they were, like the Trinity test, you know, was purely experimental. But then as this technology was developed, there was a recognition, you know, among decision makers in the military and the high echelons of decision making about atomic bomb technology, that this technology wasn't something the U.S. could sit on, that sooner or later, the Soviet Union was going to achieve this technology, and that sooner or later, other countries would have this weapon in their arsenal. And so the continuing construction and test of weapons prototypes was a way of demonstrating that the United States possessed this technology and was willing to deploy it if threatened or challenged by other nuclear-armed states. And so, you know, after the Soviet Union tests their first atomic bomb in 1949, the arms race is officially on. And after that, you can see a real direct relationship between the construction and detonation of weapons prototypes by the United States in Nevada, in the Marshall Islands, and the development and construction and detonation of Soviet bombs in the Soviet test area in Kazakhstan. It's almost like a call and response that's happening between these nuclear-armed states. And so that ongoing competition and one-upmanship maintains, you know, this furious pace of development and experimentation, which is, of course, something that produces a tremendous amount of profit for weapons manufacturing companies that are working with the Atomic Energy Commission. Nuclear technology, nuclear weapons technology is a high dollar project. This is just driving, you know, the ongoing quest by different you know, branches of the United States military to also have, you know, a piece of this action, to be able to develop weapons prototypes that are suited to their specific aims and capabilities. So not only is the United States competing against the Soviet Union during this period, building and testing and demonstrating the power of these bombs, but the various United States military branches and weapons producers are also, you know, competing to have a share of this development money and research money and these new tools in their arsenals. And so these various forces are really driving just a furious pace of weapons construction and testing during the 1950s in this period of one-upmanship between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Yeah. I think the really, at least one of the really critical questions in this story seems to be what the government knew about the risks.
Yes.
And whether they went ahead anyway because they figured the benefits were greater. Like did the government, and this is something you mentioned in the book, the question of whether the government knowingly contaminated the food supply and the air and the water of its citizens in the interest of preserving democracy. What do you think?
High-ranking decision makers within the United States government, specifically within the Atomic Energy Commission, absolutely knew that the food chain was being contaminated by nuclear weapons testing. They were monitoring that contamination as it was occurring, and they were actively suppressing that information from the public. And there's numerous instances of that that we can talk about. But from the very inception of this weapons technology, you know, coming out of the Manhattan Project during World War II, there was a scientific recognition. I mean, it predated the development of this weapons technology that radiation exposure could cause tremendous harm to biological material, to genetic material. And from the moment the United States deploys atomic bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, almost immediately, there is a scientific and medical fact-finding operation unfolding. Hmm. The Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission is developed in the wake of those bombings. And U.S. doctors and scientists are dictating the terms of research that will be conducted on the bodies of survivors of those bombings to better understand the health effects of radiation exposure. And so not everyone in the United States government and in the public health service, you know, world knew all of this information. It was certainly kept close to the chest of decision makers in the Atomic Energy Commission, because there was a perception almost immediately that, you know, the public could develop what was perceived as an unreasonable fear of radiation and fallout associated with this new kind of super weapon. And so there was a desire to control the public's understanding of those risks, because as soon as that technology was deployed against Japan, the United States had in many ways committed to the ongoing development of that arsenal.
I wanted to ask you about when the nuclear testing in Nevada begins. You write in the book that it received not much attention, which I think seems remarkable now, but you say for the first few years, people didn't really seem to find it threatening. And I'm wondering, when does that change? And what is the government, by the way, the military, the government, telling these people about these tests that are happening, you know, in the open, in the desert, a couple of hundred miles away from them? Like, what's happening in those early days of all of this?
I mean, it's important to remember that prior to the advent of atomic bomb testing and nuclear weapons testing in the Western United States, a lot of people living around the West had become accustomed to weapons testing and military exercises, you know, during World War II. There's a tremendous amount of infrastructure development and lands seized to make way for military installations, military production, military testing and exercises across the Western United States. So in some ways, for a lot of Westerners, this is another layer of that. And it's important to remember that when testing gets going in Nevada in 1951, you know, the Atomic Energy Commission still has a chokehold on public knowledge about this technology. A lot more is known about fallout. You know, a lot more has made its way into the international media. But we're wading into the Cold War and the opening of aggressions and tension with the Soviet Union. And so there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of anxiety. And there's a lot of willingness to trust the United States federal government when it says that the weapons development it is doing, these are controlled tests. These are experiments being managed by the most elite scientists and researchers in the world. And the dominance of that narrative of U.S. expertise is a really effective tool that the Atomic Energy Commission wields really deftly, you know, and they do local information campaigns during the early 1950s, where they invite local mayors to come and see an atomic bomb test, you know, take place. And they spend a lot of time and effort emphasizing to local communities that this development, this the use of this site for the testing of this weapons technology, this is a local boon. This is a tremendous boost for the economy. A lot of these rural towns are gaining, you know, jobs in conjunction with the development of these sites. And that really starts to shift in 1953. There were certainly people who were anxious about what was happening, or who saw the mushroom clouds and thought, you know, that just doesn't sit right. And the bombs that were being tested in the spring of 1953 in Nevada are some of the largest prototypes that the AEC had ever detonated in the open air. These are tests that are 30 and 40 and 50 kilotons. You know, for comparison, the bombs that we used against Japan were 15 and 21 kilotons, respectively. So these are extremely loud explosions. The force of these tests was breaking windows, you know, in downwind communities that were not so far from the test site. And the radiation that was being released, the visible fallout material that was being distributed by these clouds, first of all, was impossible for people to ignore. You know, a lot of the tests went off before the sun rose. And so people had the experience of being awoken hours before sunrise by what they thought was the sunrise. And then this, you know, concussive blast of explosive force, you know, rattling the windows and the doors. The AEC took to telling people to open their windows and doors to prevent property damage. And it became impossible for people to ignore. And one of those tests, the Harry test, became really notorious in southern Utah because the Atomic Energy Commission realized that it had enough radiation in the cloud, and it was headed directly for some of the more densely populated areas immediately downwind of the test site around St. George and Cedar City. The Atomic Energy Commission knew if people were exposed to that cloud, it would lead to visible signs of radiation illness. And by 1953, you know, there's enough references in popular culture that people would know what that was. And so they actually did something they never did before that or after. They issued a warning to people in that area to take cover. And this was something, you know, once they did that, they couldn't put that back in the bag, so to speak. Yeah. This knowledge is getting out to people that what's happening at the test site is coming to where they live. And initially, that awareness is really confined, you know, primarily to southern Utah. But during, you know, this series of tests in the spring of 1953, an event begins that ends up really seizing a lot of public attention in the region. And that's that a number of Utah sheep ranchers were herding their animals out in Nevada, not so far from the test site. It was fairly common practice for southern Utah sheepmen to take their herds out to Nevada to graze and then to bring them back into lamb in Cedar City and outside of St. George in the spring. And a number of these ranchers had direct interactions with Atomic Energy Commission personnel in the spring of 1953, who warned them that they were in a hot area with their sheep. And they were told, you've got to get out of here. You really need to evacuate this area. But these sheepmen had thousands of pregnant sheep. They could only go so fast. They were trailing them on horseback. And so they had to kind of slowly make their way back towards, you know, their farms in southern Utah. And as they did, these sheep started giving birth to horribly deformed lambs. Sheep started dropping dead. There were a number of really alarming health problems that started to manifest in the bodies of these animals that didn't match on to any of the knowledge that these ranchers had about things that could go wrong for sheep. You know, a lot of these fellows had been raising sheep in this area for generations. And when they took this issue to, you know, local veterinarians couldn't diagnose what was happening. They called in agricultural agents, extension agents, who also couldn't diagnose what was happening. And so they called in the state veterinarian and the Atomic Energy Commission to come and investigate. And the ultimate conclusion of the Atomic Energy Commission was that malnutrition and possible exposure to poisonous plants on the range is what had killed these sheep.
Now, how do you make sense of that? as a response to, you know, simple folk, I guess you could say, sheep ranchers, but who aren't stupid.
No.
How did they react to such a thing? They had concerns. They knew what was going on.
Yes.
And the Atomic Energy Commission says, oh, it's malnutrition or toxic plants. What do you make of that as just a response to these people? And how did these ranchers and others begin to react to those kinds of responses?
I think it was a fundamental miscalculation on the part of the Atomic Energy Commission. I've read the transcripts of some of these meetings that they had. And they brought in Atomic Energy Commission researchers who had been doing experiments on sheep at the Hanford site, the Hanford facility where they were producing plutonium for these bombs in eastern Washington. Mm-hmm. They brought some of these experts in to kind of try and diffuse the situation in southern Utah. And the southern Utah ranchers said, you know, you're talking about external radiation. Our sheep were eating the stuff from that test. We watched the dust come down and settle on the plants that they were browsing on. We saw them develop sores on their mouths around where they were coming into contact with this material. We saw spots on the hides of dark colored animals. We saw white spots come in where the material landed after the test. And they said, what about ingested radiation? What is the implication of ingested radiation? And they were targeting exactly what had in fact been responsible for the deaths of the sheep. And that was confirmed by the Atomic Energy Commission's own investigations. Internally, the Atomic Energy Commission said, yes, these animals have fallout lesions that are typical of what we saw downwind of the Trinity test in New Mexico. It tracks with what we're finding from our experiments on sheep at Hanford, but we cannot allow this information to become public because it could threaten our ongoing ability to test weapons in Nevada. This was the number one priority for the Atomic Energy Commission, which of course has this terrible conflict of interest, which is that they're supposed to protect the public from this technology, but also make sure this technology continues to be developed so that we remain competitive with the Soviet Union.
It's interesting. You've talked about how a lot of what you're interested in is trying to make sense of how it is society gets to the point where, you know, we accept contamination.
Yeah.
We accept testing like this. And you see, part of it is that we're told or we come to believe it's one of the costs of progress, I guess.
Exactly.
That this kind of contamination is necessary. And so in that sense, I think that the fact that especially decades and decades ago, you have people who really aren't in any way activist types. Many of them were, you know, Latter-day Saints inclined to believe their leaders and obey authority. The fact that they were starting to question things and become outspoken and become the tellers of these stories as downwinders, isn't that even all the more remarkable in some way?
Absolutely. And this has always been one of the things that's most fascinating to me about this history is the refusal of patriotic people who were deeply invested in many ways in the United States project of national security. I had folks that I interviewed in southern Utah tell me that they would support more atmospheric testing in Nevada in a heartbeat because it was what was necessary to protect the United States and our way of life. But those same people told me, I do have a problem with what they did about the sheep. And what happened is when the Atomic Energy Commission tried to paint those sheep ranchers as, you know, uneducated, provincial, rural people who had neglected their animals, it was a huge miscalculation because any of those farmers or ranchers or local people would be the first to admit they didn't know anything about nuclear radiation. They didn't know anything about nuclear physics, but they did know a lot about raising sheep. And there's a tremendous amount of respect in these southern Utah communities during this time for the knowledge that is required for these ranchers to maintain their herds and thrive in this line of work. And there's a recognition that this knowledge has been passed down among generations in this place. And so when the Atomic Energy Commission told these very patriotic, often, you know, politically conservative members of the Latter-day Saint Church, you know, this is your ignorance, it struck at the heart of the trust that a lot of these communities had of the federal government during this period, trust that had been extremely high. And in the wake of these sheep deaths, And a lawsuit that some of these ranchers filed against the federal government during this period, which I think is really remarkable, the courage that it took to hold the federal government responsible for harms in the middle of the Cold War, when to ask questions was cast as disloyal. The willingness of these ranchers to say something has gone wrong here, you know, and they weren't looking for big damages. They were just looking to stay in business. They were looking to replace the animals that they'd lost. In the few years, you know, after they lost their case in court in 1955, and a lot of these people went out of business. They weren't able to stay in the sheep industry. And a lot of them started to notice health problems in their own bodies, in the bodies of other people they'd been on the range with, and in the bodies of family members. And so there was this direct link for a lot of people emerging downwind of the test site between what had been done to the sheep, which was very well known and often discussed, and what was beginning to happen in people's bodies after, you know, several years of sustained exposure to radiation from testing in Nevada. It planted the seeds, I think, for people to start paying attention to the testing that was continuing to take place through the 1950s and into the early 1960s, and the health problems that were beginning to manifest in greater and greater numbers in these small communities, which it was really, really hard to ignore. You know, when you had multiple cases of childhood leukemia, you know, in a town of only 75 people, these stories became really fundamental to a lot of people in these areas. And it deeply undermined the integrity for many people of the federal government when it said that these tests were safe.
Sarah Fox, her book is called Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. Unless Congress acts, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act will expire on June 7th. You're listening to Radio West. Sarah, let's talk about the reason we're having this conversation now. A chapter of the story, I guess you could say, of the downwinders may be coming to an end. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act is expiring. And I guess the question is why? Why is it expiring? Has everyone who should be compensated, have they been compensated and we're just sort of closing the chapter?
You know, that's a great way to frame that question, Doug, because in a lot of ways, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Program, you know, when it was developed and passed into law in the early 90s, was about demarcating the beginning and end of this chapter of harm in American history. It was really a response to the fact that many downwinders in Utah and elsewhere, many uranium-impacted families, many of them indigenous from the Navajo Nation, had filed lawsuits saying, you know, our families were harmed, and we believe that you knew that our families were being harmed. And there was a lot of historical evidence at that point to substantiate that. And as that information came to light, you know, people filed all these lawsuits, and many of them were successful. Many of them had judges find in favor of the downwinders, find that the government had knowingly exposed people to dangerous amounts of mutagenic radiation. But these lawsuits invariably, you know, didn't succeed in bringing any sort of compensation or, you know, to the impacted communities, because they were always overturned on appeal. And so the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act and the RECA program was really a response to the failure of these lawsuits. And it was designed as what was called compassionate compensation, basically saying the federal government acknowledges that this material was released, that this material was dangerous and could have health effects, and that some people were exposed. And we can't know who in fact, we can never prove who was specifically harmed by this. But it said, you know, if you lived in a particular county and you had a particular type of cancer and you were involved in nuclear weapons development in these very specific ways, i.e. you lived in a downwind county in Nevada, Utah, Arizona during atmospheric testing, and you have a compensable cancer, you can get a small payment, $50,000 for most people. Or if you worked in the uranium industry, you know, prior to 1971, you can get a compensation payment. Or if you worked at the atomic test site, you can get a compensation payment. And you have to substantiate, you know, your residence during these times. You have to have the right kind of cancer. The cancers that are covered are very controversial. You know, and a great many cancers were excluded and health problems were excluded that we know are caused by radiation exposure.
And doesn't all of that, by the way, presume that air currents and wind didn't carry the radiation much further and that the exposure was, you know, limited to the time when the just when the bombs were the days around when the bombs were detonated? Those don't even seem like accurate presumptions looking back.
Not whatsoever. And this has been something that downwinders and uranium impacted people have been pointing out for 30 years, you know, since RICO was established, that we have a lot of data, much of it from the federal government, like the 1997 National Cancer Institute thyroid study, which just looks at thyroid cancers related to atmospheric testing, which demonstrates that some of the most heavily impacted counties in the United States are in Idaho and Montana. Mm. The idea that this contamination was contained to the small geographic area in the Great Basin, in southern Utah specifically, and northern Arizona, we've known that was a fiction for a very long time, but RICO is still based on that fiction.
So why is it expiring?
RICO was only ever designed to address a particular category of claimants who were alive at particular moments and who were exposed in particular ways and who had a limited list of particular health problems as a result. It was never intended to address the actual scope of the contamination that was produced by this period in history, or the actual scope of health problems that we know are related to that contamination. And so from the very beginning of the existence of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, there has been organizing by members of radiation-impacted communities, uranium-impacted communities, and downwinder communities to push for an expansion of this program.
Well, I want to mention, for example, at Princeton University, their program on science and global security, they released this research that shows really how expansive the radioactive fallout was from those tests. I mean, the study, for example, found that just 10 days after the Trinity test, radioactive fallout just from that test reached into 46 different states, as well as Mexico, as well as Canada. The study's also reanalyzing the fallout from all of the tests that played out in Nevada. So the sense of the fact that this was contained to, I don't know what it was, like 10 Utah counties and 19 different, you know, specific cancers from 51 to 58 and 1 month in July in 1962, you know.
It's ludicrous. It's ludicrous. But there was a recognition very early on by the folks who were designing, you know, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act specifics, is that you could never pay to compensate all the people who were actually exposed. And part of the justification is that, you know, as you get out into a larger and larger geographic area and bigger temporal span, you know, if you acknowledge that the children, you know, if you have two people who grew up downwind of the Nevada test site in the 1950s, you know, as children of the baby boom, and they fall in love and get married and have children who are born in the 1980s, the likelihood that those children will deal with health implications from their parents' exposures is very, very high. But those children are not covered by the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. People who live, you know, one county over, who have possibly the same disease, are not covered. This program would never, I think, be able to adequately compensate, you know, the numbers of people and the numbers of health problems that were created by these exposures. And so, you know, a lot of the pushes to expand RICO over the years have been driven by, you know, the recognition that there are communities where a public health crisis has been unfolding, like in Gem County, Idaho, you know, where people have lists of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in very small areas who are dealing with similar kinds of health problems. And they know from that 1997 National Cancer Institute study that their county received some of the most catastrophic iodine-131 exposures from atmospheric testing. And so part of what is powerful about RICO is RESET, the Radiation Exposure Screening and Education Program. RICO established funding for health screening in areas that are covered by this legislation. And that's one of the messages that I've heard most consistently from downwinders and radiation-impacted community members over the years, is that we need medical screening. You know, $50,000 compensation payment is meaningless when you're talking about the cost of fighting cancer. It's meaningless when you're talking about the lost income of a family member, a breadwinner, who died of cancer from radiation exposure. But one thing that people point to is the power of health screening programs to make a difference in the lives of future generations who may carry the legacies of this history in their bodies. And so I think one of the most powerful things about conversations around preserving and expanding RECA is making it possible to extend that health screening and the education of healthcare professionals in regions that have been exposed. That would have a tremendous impact on people's health. But there's a real unwillingness to fund those kind of expansions. And so, you know, RECA being set to sunset, you know, in 2022 was a recognition of the fact that people who fit the criteria, the very narrow criteria that RECA established in the early 90s, there wouldn't be any of them left after a certain point. And that this chapter would essentially fade into history. And with it, all of the questions about the full extent of the contamination and the full extent of the health problems that it unleashed. But, you know, now we have new studies coming out, like the Princeton study you referenced, that essentially shows that contamination from these tests was ubiquitous. It came down everywhere in the continental United States and beyond. It was also being released by other aspects of the nuclear weapons production cycle, by the uranium industry, which created a phenomenal amount of radiological contamination across the West, by plutonium production at Hanford in eastern Washington and at Rocky Flats in Colorado and other sites. Radiation from this weapons technology has permeated a great deal of the United States since this technology's inception in 1945. And so RECA is really was really, I think, an attempt to kind of encapsulate this history and say, you know, yes, there were some regrettable decisions, there were some harms, but they were contained in space and time. And what we know from the Princeton study, what we know from the stories of people in these counties we know were really heavily impacted, is that this history was not contained in places and it was not contained in time. The contaminations and the genetic harms that began with weapons testing in the 40s and 50s, they're still playing out in people's bodies.
Sarah Fox, her book is called Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. You're listening to Radio West. You have said that this story has not been passed on to a new generation of people growing up in Utah. Why?
From the very beginning of Downwinders talking about contamination from weapons testing, uranium-impacted people talking about contamination from the uranium industry, there has been this attitude that to raise these questions is bad for business. It makes local agriculture look bad. It's cast as the equivalent of being unpatriotic or disloyal. And inevitably, national security concerns are pointed to and are sort of weaponized against people saying, I'm concerned about the health impacts. I'm concerned about the environmental impacts of this technology, of this industry. And so it's been a very effective way. I mean, a lot of people have fundamentally been bullied into silence. Another reason why this history has often not been passed on is because it's relied on a handful of storytellers who have stepped forward and sort of taken on the pressures of being the public voice of radiation impacted communities. And they've faced, you know, activists from indigenous communities affected by uranium and activists from communities downwind of the Nevada test site or the Hanford plutonium production site have talked about receiving death threats. They've talked about being alienated in their own communities, you know, for bringing to continuing to bring attention to this issue. And when they do, the response is often that's something that happened in the past. You know, and these activities at the Nevada test site, at Hanford, at the Four Corners region uranium industry sites, these were being supervised by, you know, the brightest minds in science and technology and national security and you know, engineering, that these people always had our best interests at heart. And that narrative is deployed over and over again, you know, to silence people who are telling these stories. And a lot of the time when we lose these key storytellers, you know, people like Preston J. Truman, who testified to the harms of weapons testing for decades We lost him just a few years ago. Michelle Thomas, daughter of Southern Utah Downwinder activist Irma Thomas, you know, testified to these harms on the international stage, at conferences in Vienna, and you know, Southern Utah Downwinders have traveled to Hiroshima and Nagasaki to tell their stories. When these key storytellers have to step back from the public eye due to their own health problems, due to pressures, you know, being brought to bear on them and their families, or due to their own health problems and death, these stories stop being told as often, you know, and when they are told, people say, well, they passed the compensation program. So they did something about that, didn't they? We don't test weapons atmospherically anymore. So they did something about that, didn't they? Mm-hmm. When in fact, there's constantly pressure to resume weapons testing at the Nevada site. When I lived in Utah as a grad student, in 2005 and 2006, the Divine Strike test was proposed. It wouldn't have been a nuclear device, but it would have been set off atmospherically in an area of the Nevada test site that had hosted dozens of nuclear tests. And it would have created a 10,000-foot-high mushroom cloud that would have taken that dust and that material in the same direction that all those atmospheric clouds did from nuclear tests in the 50s, you know, redistributing this contamination. And that test was stopped by a coalition of downwinders, tribes, residents of the Wasatch Front who said, we absolutely do not accept the resumption of this kind of risk in our area. Similarly, the uranium industry has been stonewalled, you know, by tribes like the Navajo Nation. Since 2005, the Navajo Nation has refused to allow uranium development on their lands, even though they've been described by some uranium executives as the Saudi Arabia of uranium. Even though many people on the Navajo Nation are living way below the federal poverty line without access to clean water, in part because of the damages of the uranium industry during the Cold War, they still refuse to allow this technology to take place because these stories of the harm that it did are still circulating. And so even though we have way less of these storytellers with us today, the urgency of these stories remains just as great as it ever has.
Do you think the concern over climate change may have altered the way people are thinking about the costs and benefits of nuclear energy? Are people thinking differently, for example, about the whole American nuclear project and even the idea of testing, you know, nuclear devices? If nuclear energy could be an alternative to, you know, burning carbon, how is that, do you think, going to change the way people are thinking about, you know, the story of the downwinders?
There's absolutely been a sea change, I think, in attitudes towards nuclear power, even with, you know, the catastrophic Fukushima accident.
Yeah.
Because there is a recognition that the pressures of climate change call for other modes of meeting our tremendous energy needs. The problem with nuclear power production is it's never actually been separate from nuclear weapons production. You know, very early on, nuclear power was put forward as a technology that could justify the United States nuclear weapons production program. Commercial nuclear power was kind of an afterthought. It was a public relations move in a lot of ways for the Atomic Energy Commission and the U.S. government. And the production of nuclear power ultimately requires the same kind of incredibly dangerous and contaminative fuel to be extracted as weapons production does. It requires the uranium industry. We still haven't finished remediating the tremendous ecological contamination from the Cold War uranium industry. You know, there are hundreds of unreclaimed uranium sites still on the Navajo Nation today. There's an ongoing study, the Navajo Birth Cohort Study, which has found that the vast majority of infants they are sampling who are being born on the Navajo Nation today have uranium in their bodies, even though uranium hasn't been mined there since the Navajo Nation banned it in 2005. And so when people talk to me about clean nuclear, I see this real gap in understanding of the full sweep of the nuclear fuel cycle and the kinds of extractive industries and waste productions that are necessary to get that purportedly clean fuel, which incidentally, we still don't have a waste repository in the United States that can accept that spent fuel, which remains extremely dangerous.
So will we ever do this again?
I think that the likelihood of us doing this again remains extremely high. Hmm. There was actually a test that was conducted at the Nevada National Security Site, an underground chemical explosion that was designed to help improve our ability to detect nuclear weapons tests, small yield nuclear weapons tests being conducted elsewhere in the world. This justification, the national security prerogatives and the quote unquote, you know, global security prerogatives that are repeatedly advanced as justifications for the development of new weapons technology, those are even more in abundance now than they were 20 years ago. The moral of the story is always we learned lessons from history. We would never do it that way again. That's very much the line that the uranium industry uses when they try to lobby, you know, indigenous nations in the Southwest to access their uranium reserves. We won't make those same mistakes. We won't expose people in the same way. It just means ultimately exposing people in new and different ways. It means contaminating aquifers that can never be cleaned up, you know, in the case of the uranium industry, you know, proposing in situ leach mining of uranium. It means trusting new generations of technocrats with public safety when they detonate weapons designs in Nevada. And ultimately, I think the moral of the story that the downwinders have been telling for so many years is that we are often fed false assurances about the ability of the national security state to control this technology as they're developing it, and to surveil its impacts in a thorough enough way to protect public health, that we cannot take them for their word at that.
Over the years that you've been following this story, what is it, do you think, that downwinders say they really want? Because it doesn't seem to be money, of course, and it doesn't even necessarily seem to be just an apology. It seems like something else. What do they want?
I think that the message that I've heard over and over in the almost 20 years that I've been talking to downwinders is that we do not want a repeat of history. We want more data. We want health screening. You know, I have heard from downwinders, you know, who I've known now for 15 or 20 years, that health problems seem to be increasing in subsequent generations in communities in southern Utah, in St. George, for example. But what I also hear in these communities is a message that's very similar to the one shared by the Japanese hibakusha, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Overwhelmingly, the message is that this impacts everyone's bodies in the same way, that this technology is indiscriminate, and that what they are calling for is for no one else to suffer in the way that they have suffered. You know, not to put these tests underground or put them in some quote-unquote remote corner of the world, because they understand that they were that remote corner of the world for the Atomic Energy Commission, you know, whether they were in the Marshall Islands or whether they were in Cedar City or in Emmett, Idaho, or downwind of the Hanford site in eastern Washington. You know, people understand that this technology cannot be exercised in a way that is safe, and they want to see future generations spared from the kind of terrible suffering that they have experienced in their own bodies and in the bodies of their loved ones and members of their communities.
Sarah Fox, her book is called Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act is set to expire in 2 weeks. It passed the Senate, but so far in the House of Representatives, Speaker Mike Johnson has said he won't allow a vote. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We'd love to hear from you with comments or questions. You can email us at radiowest@KUER. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.